You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and these are our interviews with the star of The Killing of Two Lovers, Clayne Crawford, and the sound re-recording mixer and sound designer, Peter Albrechtsen, by Will Mavity, here on the Next Best Picture podcast.
Hey, Alex.
Yeah?
What do you call a pile of kittens?
What?
A meowton.
God, Dad.
Meowton!
Terrible.
Live my life painted in a corner.
You working?
Yeah.
This early?
Yeah, Dad. Stop digging.
I think we're doing the right thing.
David, I love you. You love me. We're trying to figure this out. By the
time I'm listening, Dad.
Love is a feeling, and feelings, they move in, they move out. Darling. Mom's cheating on you.
All right, everyone, you are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. I am your host, Matt Neglia, and today I am very, very excited to be joined here by the star of The Killing of Two Lovers, Clayne Crawford. Clayne, how are you today?
I'm good, Matthew. How are you?
Doing well. Doing super well. I'm extraordinarily happy that this film is finally out and available for people to see, considering I saw it at the world premiere at Sundance 2 years ago, and it just feels like forever at this point.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, thank you for checking out the film at Sundance. Yeah, you know, look, this pandemic has kind of put a wrinkle in everything, hasn't it? We were so grateful for Neon to kind of come on board. But when they said they wanted to wait till theaters open, we panicked a little bit. But, you know, if this thing had come out 6 months ago, the excitement would already be over. So it's nice to have it coming out now. And the fact that theaters are starting to open back up a little bit more, it's all very exciting.
Absolutely. And also, too, it's got a VOD release as well for those who maybe, you know, cannot check it out in theaters. So it's widely available. And I have been urging everyone I know to check it out, because for my money, it's one of the best independent films of this year. And your performance in it is a large reason for that. So really, really appreciate you taking the time today.
Look, that movie was a labor of love for sure. So the pleasure is all mine. I appreciate you taking the time and for your kind words.
Yeah, not a problem. So talk to me a little bit about that in regards to getting hooked up with Robert. He obviously had a hand in, well, pretty much everything with this movie, from editing, directing, writing, and producing. So how did you guys get linked up on this? Did the script come to you? Did you audition? Like, what was the process?
No, I met Robert in 2009 at Sundance. We both had films up there. He had a short. It may have been his first short that he had at Sundance. It was Jack and the Rabbit. And I fell in love with his style and the way he was able to create so much tension by doing very little, just his style alone. So immediately I was excited to work with Robert, and he had sent me a script that we tried to get made for a couple of years. And then I would go off to do a job and he would go make something else. And that kind of went on with different pieces of material. But like I said, you know, up until 2018, and I found myself a little with some time on my hands, and we'd been unable to get anyone to kind of believe in our vision. So I just said, look, what if I finance the film? Well, you know, to say that we came into this with this idea that we're going to go make this feature that everyone was going to kind of be able to see, that's not the case. For me, it was more about taking very limited resources. We had, you know, 40 grand, which we ended up spending 32,000 of it on the film. But I said, look, if we take 40 grand and we just go shoot something that shows what we can accomplish if someone gave us a real budget, you know, if they gave us, you know, $500,000 to $1 million.
Sure.
And Robert was excited about that. So he had this short that he had written called The Drift. And he sent that to me in August of 2018. And I said, if you can build on this and create and kind of let's stretch it out into a feature length, I really think this is doable as it relates to the finances that we had. Because it was such a small contained story that was truly about performances, which, you know, as a fan of European cinema, where they don't have the resources like we do in the States, you know, they have to focus on talent, on the talent itself and on great storytelling. So I was intrigued. So Robert went back and he started writing, and he called me in October. Now granted, we kind of did a lot of work together as far as the character, and he and I are both fathers, and we cherish that role greatly. And our children, like all dads, you know, it kind of changed our lives. So kind of building David in this story was just really interesting to us. And in October, he sent me a draft, which was The Killing of Two Lovers. And I mean, Matt, I fell in love with it. You know, that opening scene. What was exciting for me was we didn't have to explain the why.
Yeah.
We were in a situation where it's escalated to this point that we realize instantly that David is at the edge. He's at the end of his rope, right? He's on the edge of the cliff, grasping to reality. Mm-hmm. So yeah, man, he sent me the draft in October and we were on set shooting the day after Thanksgiving. And we shot it in 12 days and we just pumped it out. Yeah, man. But again, there was zero pressure. It was just like, let's just go, right? And mm-hmm. it doesn't matter if we lose every dollar. And we shot with that free kind of approach. And then Robert sent me the first cut and I was like, holy cow, man, this is an actual film. And it really well. And that was me watching it in black and white, with zero sound. I was like, holy crap, we might have something.
You mentioned it being very freeing, and a lot of the dialogue exchanges take place over these long extended takes with barely any edits. When there is an edit to a close-up, it's very purposeful in when it's reacting to a specific moment. So for you as an actor, and I imagine this was very theatrical, very play-like to be able to act in some of these scenes, what was that like for you?
Liberating. Mm-hmm. You know, having, you know, because again, knowing that we had 12 days, knowing that we had such limited time and money, we just knew traditional coverage wasn't going to be an option.
Sure.
And Robert, you know, he's a photography professor at BYU. Mm-hmm. So for him, composition is extremely important.
It shows.
It does show, right? And he goes, look, I feel like this needs to, each frame needs to almost be a living photograph. And I said, that's really interesting. And he goes, I only want to use cuts for close-ups in the car with you and Nikki. Mm-hmm. And he goes, but I want to be a little, I don't want to be traditional. Because we knew, look, this is an art project, essentially. So we don't have to follow any rules. And he goes, like, I want to be on the opposite actor when one's talking. So the focus is going to be on the listening. And I just thought that was so incredible. And it gave us the opportunity, like you suggested, it was like a play. Mm-hmm. So because we shot in this little tiny town of Kanosh, Utah, which I think at the time was population 360.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, Matt, there's nothing either direction for 45 minutes in either direction. So truly isolated.
Yeah.
So there was no distractions for us as actors. So yes, we only had 12 days, but what we did was rehearse any chance we had, meaning if we were not on camera shooting at that moment, we would walk over to the house and meet Chris and Seth. He would run through that big 17-minute scene because it was so much dialogue and so much blocking. But again, never was this a hindrance for us. It was a stage, like you said, and mm-hmm. and it gave us the opportunity without having cuts. It allowed us to know that A, it's going to live as one piece, mm-hmm. so it has to be right. There is no chance of cutting in and out. So, but the gift that came with that was each moment before could build on the other. So we were never, you know, in traditional filmmaking, you have to pace your performance in a way.
Sure.
You have to say, okay, we're in the wide shot. I'm going to kind of go big. And then as we move into the tight coverage, I'm going to kind of contain it all, which is somewhat manipulative at times, right? And mm-hmm. certainly it's on the forefront of your mind. You're working like this, all that technical BS is completely pushed to the side and you only focus on the performance.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. And, yeah. and like I said before, like not just in his photography, but it shows too in the performances, because they're just so incredibly lived in and so genuine. Like one of my favorite aspects of this movie is that there's equal weight given on both sides of the argument of the characters, where no one is necessarily in the wrong or in the right. It's just a fact of life people fall in love, people fall out of love, and sometimes there isn't a bad guy involved necessarily. And I just love that approach to this method of storytelling. As you mentioned before, you're a father. So like that approach that I just mentioned before, taking the melodrama out of it, and you coming at this as a father yourself, on a purely like just emotional level, like what did that ultimately mean for you as a father?
Well, it meant that it wasn't a stretch for me to get there emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
I personally can't imagine not having my little guys with me. I mean, I'm on set right now and my son's in the next room.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Like I just cherish being a father and not having those little moments with them. You know, going to breakfast, walking them to school, whatever it may be, to lose that and know that I have to try to cram all that time into a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Man, the pressure that it puts on them and as a mother or father is just so, so strained. It puts such a strain on the relationship. So, you know, it was again, because of the 12 days, it allowed me to completely immerse myself. There was no coming up for air.
Mm-hmm.
And that's challenging when you're working for 6 months, it's almost impossible.
Mm.
But on a film like this, with that much time, again, it just goes back to those luxuries.
Yeah. It almost feels like a sprint at times, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and sometimes on those really long shoots, it's more of a marathon, and mm-hmm. I can run sprints all day. So, and again, knowing that we had that kind of world that, you know, you suggested where there is no good guy or bad guy. You know, I think traditionally Hollywood wants to put a black hat on this guy and a white hat on the other. And that's just not how life is. It doesn't right. represent the reality that we all live in,
mm-hmm.
basically, which is, you know, you and I are quite capable of doing some really beautiful things. But if someone walks through that door and they've got something in their hand to attack my child, I'm liable to rip his face off.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's
sure. not,
those two things are so contradictory. But I find we as humans, it just depends on the scenario that we find ourselves in, how we mm-hmm. react. I'm different with my mom than I am with my wife, you know, as we all are. And I don't think that's conveyed. I feel a lot of times it's we only see characters through one lens.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is a disservice.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely understand that as well. You mentioned before that you saw the first cut of the film, black and white, no sound. So it must have come as quite a surprise to you, not knowing necessarily on set when you're filming it, how the sound of this movie was going to come together. When you saw that final cut and you heard all of those metallic grinding sounds and everything else that Robert threw in there, what was your initial reaction? Because it's so unlike anything else I've heard in recent memory.
You know, I think a lot of times people kind of stylize a film just for the sake of it. You know,
mm-hmm.
for us, the 4x3 was designed to make the audience feel claustrophobic at times.
Yep.
And that, you know, for instance, when David's in the truck,
mm-hmm.
You can't see in front of him or behind him. And I don't think David can see in front of him or behind him. So that was really kind of crucial. As it relates to sound, you know, this was a long process and there was no one else. You know, Robert and I were the only producers. We were the only kind of creatives involved. So yes, the first cut being black and white, I was blown away. And then as we moved into color, that was very exciting. And then we brought Peter Albrechtsen on, who was our sound designer.
Great guy. And
man, Peter, he's from Copenhagen, Denmark. You know, the mm-hmm. Dutch have always... They've always been on the forefront of sound, haven't they? I mean, they just push the envelope when it comes to creative. And
he listens to my show, so he's probably going to listen to this, and he's going to love that you said that, I'm sure.
Well, hey, Peter knows I love him because I just hired him to come do my next film, right? So that Robert
Perfect.
And I just finished. So I fly to Copenhagen literally in 2 weeks.
Nice.
Yeah, because our U.S. embassy denied him his work visa, so now we're going there, which is fine.
And yeah.
Excited. I've never been to Copenhagen, so I'm fortunate or excited for the opportunity.
Nice.
Yeah, Peter is super talented, and we explained, you know, Robert comes from a music background. His father mm-hmm. taught music his whole life, and Robert had kind of been talking about this Funkette kind of approach, and I wasn't familiar with it. And when I watched that first cut, and it's David starts climbing out of that window, and the door slamming and the creaking of the ship and the hammer and the chamber being spun on the revolver, I was like, holy cow. Peter, you know, a lot of times, Matt, you go with the sound designer and you spend all of your effort and time just trying to get it to where you feel like it should be.
Right.
Send a film to Peter. He comes in the first pass, he's already exceeded your expectations.
Oh, yeah.
So for us, listening to that first cut, it just blew us away because it defined what David was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is, you know, to kind of explain some of those sounds, I think the door in Killing Two Lovers, there's a truck door opening and closing like 76 times.
Yeah.
Right? You hear the door slam. So Peter's thought process was, that's all David hears. The truck, the gun, the creep, like this is just, and it was so exciting to elevate the film with that sound design. And I think in a lot of ways, it's an appearance.
Yeah, I think so too. It helps with the tension and the immersion, as you mentioned before as well. So all of it pieces to come together as a whole. We're just about out of time here. So I always like to wrap up these interviews by asking one question. And sometimes people can tell me, sometimes they can't. What is next, if you can tell us, for you?
I can tell you. I was just, you know, as I said, Robert and I went and made our second film in December. Now, granted, you know, one film was made for 30 grand. The other one was made during a pandemic. So both of us are just eager to make a film without any of these restrictions. But
yeah.
we got a film, The Integrity of Joseph Chambers.
Mm-hmm.
It's starring Jordana Brewster, Michael Raymond James, Jeffrey Dean Morgan. We're really excited. As I said, I fly to Copenhagen in a couple of weeks. So we'll be finishing up sound. And then our goal is to submit to Venice.
Nice.
They were really excited about the Killing of Two Lovers before the pandemic hit. And they've just been very generous through this process. I'm hoping we have a premiere there. That's really not our concern. Our focus right now is just making the film great and make it kind of live up to what our expectations are. And we're excited for Peter to get his hands in it and start doing what Peter does.
I mentioned in my review for The Killing of Two Lovers that it's the kind of discovery film that makes you so excited to see what everyone does next. So hearing you say that just makes me even more excited than I was before. So thank you very much for sharing that.
Hey, man, we got the band back together. So hopefully, hopefully our sophomore, we don't hit a sophomore slump.
Yeah. Lightning might strike twice. We'll see. Well, in any event, Clayton, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really, really appreciate it.
Matt, I appreciate you taking the time. And again, thanks for all your kind words, man.
Absolutely. You have a good rest of your day.
Cheers.
Would you hit me? What's his name?
Derek.
Yeah, it's so late.
No, I didn't get to say bye, so I just want to come by and say goodnight, and I love you.
I only agreed to do this because you promised me that we were going to work through this.
You need to fight. You need to fight for us. David, can you look at me?
This is my family. They're worth it.
My life painted in a corner.
All right, so dude, I mentioned this online, but I can't remember the last time an audio track made me as uneasy as this one did. It's phenomenally uncomfortable. So first off, there's no composer credited here, right? Like you are the score effectively as well.
Yeah, exactly. So Robert decided to make this movie with no score, with no music, and only work with sound. And he still just the other day he had a laugh because he was thinking of when we were mixing and like 2 days in, and I'm kind of like sitting with my sound effects and sound design and like looking at him and saying, you know, Robert, I'm kind of the composer of this film. And then he looked at me and said, well, I could have told you that from the very start. And just laughed.
Because it's and you literally do incorporate some instruments, don't you? I thought I heard like a bass going at times. And certainly the you have a bell or something. I mean, there's percussion aspects that do become musical, right? Like you use some instruments.
I actually don't use any instruments. It's all like different metal sounds that I recorded. Like I love recording new sounds for every film I do. And a couple of years ago, I did this monster movie where there's a big monster fight taking place in a car, actually on the roof of a car. And I had my assistant go to this like car scrapyard and like smash up a car. And then when I was doing Killing of Two Lovers, Robert from the very beginning wanted to like have this sound collage that was kind of like the sound of the inside of the main character in a way. And because so much of the film takes place in David's car, the main character's car, I was thinking, okay, let's try and use sounds of a car. And then I was like, I had this flashback to these sounds. And so like, it's a combination of like car doors being slammed, there's car alarms, and then there's a lot of metal scratching and screeching, which is a lot of that comes from these recordings of like a car getting torn apart. And then I just built that rhythmically. So, I mean, it comes from Robert having this idea that he wanted to kind of reference this this musical style called musique concrète. It was invented in France back in the 1940s and was a style of music where you didn't use instruments but made music with sounds. And a lot of this music is quite rhythmical. So often when you kind of do sounds that are more expressive or like it's about like saying something about the inside of the character, it's often more like drones or like tones. And Robert really wanted something that had a rhythm. So from the very beginning, I've made this collage of like metal hits and stuff that created this rhythm. And I sent this to Robert while he was editing the film. Robert was also the picture editor of the film. And I was super nervous because I was thinking, okay, this sound collage is really crazy in a way. Like, okay, who the hell would do like something like this, which is built from car doors and car alarms and a car being torn apart? But Robert, he loved it. But actually it took a week for me to, like, I sent it off to Robert and I didn't hear back from him. And I was thinking, okay.
You're fired.
Now I'm getting fired. Or like, now I'm not working on this movie anymore. And then Robert sent a new version of the cut back. And then he had taken this collage that I'd done and then put it in, like, I think 5 different places in the film, because he loved it so much. So that was really the beginning of using this kind of abstract sound collage as pretty much as music in the film. So it became like a theme throughout the film that you return to again and again.
Yeah, how did you guys, was it Robert's idea to use, it seems like, I wouldn't say most, but a large number of scenes, the transitions are always punctuated by, it sounds like you're like hitting a saucepan. There's like a bing. Was that just one of the many sounds you gave Robert and he's like, all right, we're doing this? Or was that kind of your idea that works as like a scene transition device?
That was actually a part of this like first sound collage that I did. And it was actually like me thinking, okay, there needs to be a little humor as well here. So it was like dang, 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 dang.
And is that exactly Robert what just it was? Loved that.
So he it used it several places.
It's hilarious.
It's this thing where I had these crazy ideas and then gave those to Robert, and then he just built on that and made it even crazier in a way.
Greetings from Evergreen Podcasts. We're rolling out a listener survey, and we want to hear from you. The information in the survey will help us gather statistics and in turn make our shows more appealing to advertisers. I know most people don't like ads, but this is one of the only ways our shows make money and help keep their lights on. We promise it will only take a few minutes, but the impact on our podcasts will be tremendous. As a token of our appreciation, we'll randomly select one lucky participant each month to win an exclusive merchandise package from Evergreen Podcasts. Head to evergreenpodcast.com/listenersurvey to help a show and possibly get some free stuff for doing so. We can't thank you enough for the support. Now back to the show.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.
Was it weird for you also, as both the sound designer and the re-recording mixer, basically being told, you know, usually there's a whole idea of like, if the audience like is thinking about the sound when they're watching a movie, you've done it wrong. Was it weird having a film where basically it seems like the director was like, no, I want them always to be thinking about the sound, and getting to really play with the levels to make sure, oh, we all notice the sounds there.
Robert really wants to use the sound for telling his story. And he's really not afraid of sound. He's actually like, he really inspires you to explore and experiment all the time. So it feels really good to kind of work together, even though it's also like you're, as a creative collaborator, I'm definitely like getting pushed into doing something that is quite like different than what you would normally do. But it's also super inspiring, because you get this feeling that, okay, we're doing something special, and you're experimenting with things, and then you're realizing, okay, this is really something that gives this film its special, unique voice. And Robert really wanted the sound to be a prominent part of the storytelling. So in many ways, not just with these sound collages, but also just building an environment and constantly all these textual elements that are in there, and really playing around with also the dynamics of sound. So there are moments that are super loud, and then there are moments that are super quiet.
Yeah.
And I really loved that, those kind of dynamics as well. And Robert shot the film in a way with these very, very long takes,
mm-hmm.
where, I mean, the action is kind of unfolding in front of our eyes. That means that there's a lot of room for sound, because there's time to kind of like create like an environment and really embrace the characters and with sound. So it means that because of this way of shooting the film, that sound really had a prominent place in the film.
Well, I was actually curious about that, because I know it was a contender for the Indie Spirit Award. I don't remember what the category is, but it's their ultra low budget category. So I know he wasn't working at a huge budget. There's a lot of scenes where action and dialogue, because of these kind of static long takes, are off screen. So I assume you had to do ADR work and all kinds of other stuff. Tell me about working with pretty slim budgetary constraints to kind of build this Sonic world when you don't have a huge budget to play with.
Actually, what is pretty amazing about this film is that what Robert said from the beginning was that when he wrote the script, then he mailed me and said, Peter, I need you to do this movie. We had worked on his previous feature, When She Runs, mm-hmm. which he did together with his director partner, Rodrigo Beck. And we really hit it off doing that film. And I think Robert was just like, okay, now is the time to really explore what we can do with sound. So he had this idea from the very beginning that sound was going to be a big, big part of this story. So already, like, actually in the budget, half of the budget of the film paid for the sound.
Oh, wow.
So he, of course, it was still low budget, but the amount of, like, money put into the sound was outstanding for the size of the film it was. Just that in itself was, like, I mean, for me, so incredibly privileged and, like, just amazing that you could really feel how important sound was to Robert. And that wasn't just something that he was saying, sound is important. No, it was actually like putting his money into it. But of course, the thing in this film is that, as you're saying, like, lots of things are happening off screen. There's actually very little ADR in the film. I had an amazing dialogue mixer on the film called David Barber, who he was able to clean up the most noisy stuff. And even what we realized during the dialogue mixing was that something that David Barber tried very early on was taking one scene and then splitting out the dialogue so that it was panning together mm-hmm. with the characters. And that worked so well. He just did it for one scene and we were like, this is amazing, because suddenly you really felt the distance between the characters. Like,
yeah,
that's David in one side and his wife in the other side. Then we did that in all the scenes. Some of the scenes were only recorded with one microphone. So to be a little bit technical, like what David did was like taking the signal and then removing, for example, in the fireworks scene with the kids, there's only a mic like close to David, and he's got a radio mic as well. So he was like, David was able to take David's dialogue and then remove the sounds of the kids from that, then put that on the left side. And then on the right side, he removed David's dialogue from the same signal and then only had the kids' voices.
Oh, that is
so
wild.
We did a lot of that stuff. So, I mean, really, 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 like, in a way, a lot of manipulation, but it really created this amazing feeling of having the dialogue, like, underscoring this feeling that the characters are very distanced to each other.
Yeah, it's a film where you really can hear kind of, you know, they shot it. It looks like it's in Colorado or Utah or something. And this emptiness and wideness really plays. And I hear that in the fireworks scene too. That's an incredibly uncomfortable scene to watch, the way it builds with the awkwardness. You mentioned manipulation. I know you're a guy who likes to record sound effects. What kind of distortion did you do in general to say, because I know you have, it sounds like there's like a feedback loop from a mic that's playing in the background. Tell me about some of the sounds that you just really stretched and distorted in here.
There's lots of different stuff in there where we really like mistreating sounds. Some of it is using an old tape recorder to then record sounds onto an old, old analog tape, and then record it very loudly so it distorts, and then take it back into Pro Tools and then use that because it has this really intense texture. There's a lot of stuff where I'm doing like these crazy delays, and there's a scene where Robert comes back to his father's house after having had a really bad experience with his wife, and he gets really angry and he beats up this doll
it's like a punching bag dummy. Yeah,
exactly. And it goes totally ballistic, and I did all kind of weird distortions of Clayne Crawford's voice and breaths, and just to get this in, I mean, this feeling that what you hear is not reality, it's how David hears it. So there's a lot of like, whenever he gets really angry, then things distort. There's also like when he's driving, sometimes like if you can feel that he's uneasy, then I took these sounds of, I mean, I recorded some really like noisy cars, like that are like playing then on top of like a car engine. So you just have this feeling that there's something wrong, and it's a way of creating this uneasiness that goes with David. And then in some places it becomes all quiet, and like, so there's constantly this feeling that you're in a sonic environment that in a way reflects the main character's inside.
There's a really intense scene in the film where he takes that dummy and he puts it in a field and he shoots at it. Tell me, I thought it was interesting because that's a scene where you have a lot of this this non-diegetic sound, but then also it's very pronounced, it's a very wide shot, but all the sounds, like even though the camera's set up across a field from him, you can hear something like he's got a revolver and you hear the clink of the bullets in his hand when he puts them in there, as if you're right there. And then you also still have this underlying layer of the ding, boom, in the background. So tell me a little bit about that scene, because I really love that moment.
This film, there's so much rhythm to the sounds, and like kunk, boom, ksh, kuh. And for me, a lot of these things that he's doing with the gun also had a rhythm. So I'm often approaching sound effects like they are musical instruments. So whenever I hear something that has a tonality or a rhythm, I often like enhance that or really try to kind of create a certain rhythm with that. And I love those sounds of the gun. And then I also love the sound of when you actually hear the gunshots in this like vast echo. So there was this constant dynamic flight between being very close to David and hearing all the small sounds, but also being in this like giant landscape where like the sound just echoes forever. It's one of those scenes where you would normally place a piece of music because there's no dialogue. You would, as a director, you would often kind of put in a piece of music kind of saying, okay, what are we supposed to feel here? And I think it becomes so much more interesting because there's not a piece of music telling us what to feel. There's these sounds which create this rhythm, but also creates this feeling of someone who's like on the verge of a breakdown, but mm-hmm. also at the same time who has this enormous intensity. It feels like you're very close to David, and at the same time, we're also experiencing what it is he's doing. So there's no music to tell us if we should be afraid or if we should, is he preparing for something good or is he preparing for something bad? Is it what's going on? And I really like that. I feel that it's a big part of the fascinating like storytelling in the film, that you don't really know what's going to happen next. And I like that the sounds are not necessarily, I mean, that they are mixed in an unnatural way. Like sometimes some sounds are suddenly loud and then they become quiet, and we're not mixing this film in a naturalistic way. We're mixing it very much in an emotional way. And for me, when working on the film, the more I worked on it, the more it was evident that if we really like use the sounds in the most kind of expressionistic way and the most emotional way, the most subjective way, then you also got closer to this character who in a way is unsympathetic. Like you open the film with him like pointing a gun towards his wife. So that's something that's quite like unsympathetic. But because we experience the film in the same way as he's experiencing it, the scenes, it means that we really you identify with him. It's really interesting. So suddenly you feel that, wow, this character, he's really interesting. He's like, whoa, this, what's going on? And so you're there with him because you feel what he feels.
Yeah, no, I think you tapped into something, which is that I think the reason this film got me so much is I was so anxious, because you're right, there's nothing to guide me. And you're also right, he's not that sympathetic character, but you're on the edge of your seat. You don't know if he's going to turn into like Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver, or if it's a redemption story. It's very effective. And I really did think this film is, even on such a small budget, is really pushing the boundaries of what you can do with sound and telling a story. I think it is, it's pretty groundbreaking, pretty important that. So we're about out of time here, but A, what was your favorite scene to work on here? And B, anything else you really want to tell me and everyone who's listening to this about the fucking awesome sound design you did here?
Thank you. I think my favorite sound in the film is actually one of the smallest, tiniest sounds, which is like, it's the first time that David runs into his wife's new boyfriend at like this local grocery shop, and mm-hmm. he decides to follow him in his car, and he drives away, and you can feel the aggression in the car. I put it in animal roars, like lion roar, cool. And tiger roar for his car. Then he drives away and it gets all quiet, and you hear these leaves in the wind like across the street before you then cut to like him driving and trying to like stop the boyfriend, and and David is almost run over by a truck that's passing him, which you don't see but only hear. And that small sound of the leaves, for me, that's this kind of moment where kind of like the silence before the chaos, in a way. I really love those moments, and that's definitely one of my favorite sounds.
Yeah.
Generally, I'm really happy about like how we used sound in a way where it's saying so much about the characters and the emotions. And I love the amount of cows mooing in the background. And then I love towards the end, there's a really significant use of total silence that I also really love, which I don't want to say what happens, but it's a very important moment in the story.
Well, Peter, this is fantastic. I can't wait for everyone to see and hear this movie. I know you got something big. You can't tell us what it is yet, but are there any projects that have been announced that we can look forward to hearing your sound in this year?
The great thing is that Robert and I are working on a new film. The Integrity of Joseph Chambers is the title, and Clayne Crawford is starring again. And we're going to mix that already next month. So
amazing.
Robert is really, really fast. And I mean, as Robert told me, like when doing Killing of Two Lovers, that Peter, there was like, there's a lot of moments in that film with very little dialogue. And in this film, there's even less dialogue.
God, that's wild. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, so that'll be out later in the year, we hope. So, yeah, it's an ongoing collaboration, and it's super inspiring.
I can't wait to hear that, too. Well, Peter, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's always great to catch up, and I'm glad that you helped bring us this awesome-sounding movie.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Will.
Absolutely.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to my interview with Clayne Crawford and Will Mavity's interview with Peter Albrechtsen here on the Next Best Picture podcast for The Killing of Two Lovers. The film is currently available in theaters and on VOD from Neon, and we highly urge you to check out one of the best indie gems of the year. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you'll get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you so much for listening, as always, and we shall see you all next time.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.